Hi, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live, a presentation of a personal story and a love letter to follow, because I know that every relationship and every experience has in it the seeds of a significant letter to someone. And sometimes they're just personal, sometimes they're historically important, and whatever they are, they should really be written, stamped, and mailed to someone for a little bit of joy out there. And today's guest is Alan Ross, who is a musician and my friend since we were, 12 years old?
Something like that.
So, Alan, I'm going to go to you, and I just want to say, when I heard that Doc Watson died, I thought of you immediately because I know what a huge part he played in your life and in your music and in your heart, and I'm guessing that you played a significant one in his, too. Will you talk about how you started in music and anything you want, really?
Yes. I started way back in music playing the clarinet, but in terms of this, for this interview, mm-hmm. I started playing music with the folk revival.
But what took you from clarinet to folk?
Hatred of the clarinet.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you went to guitar.
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, I stopped playing for a while. The deal was my father said, if you still hate it when you're bar mitzvahed, you can quit it. Then years later, I found folk music. Actually, I found a way to get to social interaction, girls.
Oh, with, I knew what that meant,
with folk music, mm-hmm. and I got hooked. And I got very involved in where the folk music renaissance was going, which was deeper and deeper into roots.
Whose?
American uh-huh. traditional music. Uh-huh. Blues and uh-huh. eventually what became known as bluegrass. Traditional American music played by the real people.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, as you know, I went to Cal. And Cal is a place that revered and fossilized real people music
mm-hmm.
Like nobody else did. But it did help me come to understand what the real stuff was about. And the real stuff was always listening to records and trying to emulate the old-time people until somebody came to California in folk festivals and a couple of venues, particularly in the Ash Grove in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And that was
that.
A group named Clarence Ashley. Clarence Ashley was an old-time player who the mandarins and folk music, especially at Folkways Records, brought back mm-hmm. to recreate some of his stuff. But Clarence brought with him a small band,
mm-hmm.
The guitarist in which was Doc Watson.
Mm-hmm.
And
how old was he then?
Doc, okay, let's see, we can date it right away. He was 89
mm-hmm.
when he died,
mm-hmm.
which was this year. Help.
Oh, I see, okay.
Help.
So 40 years ago, 50 years
yes.
ago.
Yes, oh yeah, 50
years. Okay.
Yeah, 1965
right.
was when I met him.
Yeah.
And he was doing stuff that nobody had ever heard of. You know, when you hear and read about what he's doing, what he brought to it, you hear that he played very fast, and he could put fiddle tunes
mm-hmm.
on the guitar. He's not the first person to put fiddle tunes on the guitar. What he brought and what doesn't get really put into words is he made the instrument, the guitar, sound like a full band.
Oh, yes.
Now, the only way that had been done up until that time, and you know I can share this with you because you know what's going on, is finger picking,
mm-hmm.
where you played
mm-hmm.
an alternating
yes.
bass with your
yes.
thumb and picked out the melody in your finger. And it was very good. It was not a full sound. It was kind of a sparse sound.
Mm-hmm.
Bum, 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 bum. Doc played a brushing stroke with his right hand, obviously,
mm-hmm.
getting the bass strings with a kind of a rhythmic brush, and then leaping out and into the top strings, the treble strings, so that there was a full sound. There was like it wasn't a big band sound; it was mm-hmm. a string band
mm-hmm.
sound. You didn't need nothing else. You didn't need a mm-hmm. banjo, fiddle, or harmonica. Or something
uh-huh.
he played harmonica, and that sounded great. And I'm not saying that he didn't augment those instruments like nobody I've ever mm-hmm. heard. But and I played with him a lot.
How did you meet him? I mean, I knew him only as bluegrass. I didn't know anything
yeah.
about folk.
Yeah. One night I got a call from Ed Pearl, the owner of the Ash Grove, and it went something like this. Alan,
mm-hmm.
where are you? Hi, Ed. What do you mean? Where are you? I don't know what you mean. Well, Doc is at the airport right now, and there's nobody there to meet him. Was I supposed to meet him? Alan, you know that you're the blah, 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 blah. So that's how I raced down to the airport. He didn't have anybody with him. There was supposed to be somebody that met him. It was Ed Pearl doing his little number of making everybody feel a part of everything, if you will. And,
but you were already playing.
Oh, I had been playing for years.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so can you
was the right guy. I mean, I was the right guy to pick up Doc Watson at the airport.
Can you go back a little and talk about your playing in the band you were with and your time in L.A.?
Sure.
I'd like to not forget about that because that's important.
1959, year summer between high school and college, sat with my girlfriend, Nancy, and a couple of other friends at the beach. She had an old Stella. Somebody showed me the chords to Besame Mucho.
Huh.
I said, this is, you know, I got a third degree burn almost that day, but I got absolutely hooked on it. Len Talmy was the other guy in that foursome.
Yes.
And he showed me some stuff and introduced me to people.
Len Talmy, by the way, just so you know, is one of our great linguists.
Yes. He is. He is the anti-Chomsky, you know.
I know. Okay, go ahead.
And
that's
he doesn't even know he's the anti-Chomsky. Yes. Yes, he does.
Okay, so when did you? How did you go from that to playing in a band?
Okay, that's skipping a lot of cards, but I got I went from what he was showing me to, let's say, the Kingston Trio for about 5 minutes, but only 5 minutes, and then from there to Theodore Bekele, which was ethnic stuff, which pulled me to the Ash Grove, which got me to see Flatten Scruggs.
Oh, wow.
And get more. I saw Flatten Scruggs, and I said, this is it. I'm home. This is it. I don't want to do nothing else.
Isn't that interesting how something will just let you know that this is what you're wired for?
I was jumping up and down. Uh-huh. I was in the audience, and I was jumping up and down. And I ran up to Dave Cohen afterwards, because then brought him into my life. And I said, what's that thing he's calling? What is that called? He said, well, that's Scruggs style. Well, what is it? Well, it's just a way of picking the banjo with your three fingers. I said, but it's so exciting. He said, yeah, a lot of people think that. And it was. It was incredibly exciting. And I got into that almost immediately, and I gravitated towards the real stuff. In other words, Flatten Scruggs were great. They were everybody's entree into the thing. But if you were really into the old-time music, and he's making quotes with his fingers, then you got a little bit more into stuff that was edgier, let's put it that way. Like the Stanley Brothers. I don't know if that means anything to you. People heard
definitely.
Of the Stanley Brothers with Wherefore Art Thou, My Brother.
I've got Sirius on my car radio, and so I've got a bluegrass station, which is just,
Well, I got more into that, and I found out that there was a real thriving bluegrass community in Berkeley, at Cal. These were not real tenant farmers. They thought that maybe they were, but they really weren't. They were more like Jewish radicals and like that. But they were people that shared that love of the old-time music. Yeah. And I worked my ass off. The guy that I played with today reminded me, he said, you really would shed it. And I did. I quit school. I dropped out of the honors program at Cal in the middle of my junior year to go live in Mill Valley and learn to play guitar. Just spend 8 hours a day playing guitar.
I did not know that.
And I thought that that was task that you didn't want to set for yourself. You didn't want to set for yourself the task of playing 8 hours a day. It wasn't. It was no contest. People ask me, well, how do you practice that? It's never been practiced. I mean, I couldn't keep my hands off the guitar. It's why I left school, because I was starting to get bad grades in school because I was playing guitar all the time. Somebody said, why don't you take my honors professor, Dr. Jacobson, said, look. And he gave me this great story about when he was doing his PhD in Massachusetts someplace. And he kept looking out the window and seeing the ocean, the surf coming in, and wishing that he would be able to, you know, fish in the surf. And finally he said, the hell with it. You know, he went out and got himself a rod and a reel. And then every day for an hour at 3 o'clock he went out and, and surfed. And that's what did it for him. Well, he said, do it. You know, go surf fish. And and I did.
Now, talk about the band you were with, because that was important.
In the bluegrass band. Okay, that was...
Well, all of them. I mean, you did more than that.
Yes, I did.
Okay, so we'll start wherever you want, really.
Well, that was a bluegrass band. Mm-hmm. That was the real deal, as far as college kids go. It was a it was a Berkeley group that had kind of shifting personnel, But I kind of became the go-to guitarist, which made me feel great. The guy that I saw today, Scott Hambly, was the go-to mandolin player and singer. I did a little bit of vocal backup. Banjo players came and went. All of them exciting. All of them good. All of them.
Banjo is a tricky instrument.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and they were all just wonderful, and they cycled through. And that was called the Ridge Runners.
Oh, that's what I wanted to know.
Yeah.
Okay, yes.
It sort of went in and out of the personnel of another band that had been around longer called the Redwood Canyon Ramblers. Mm-hmm. And that's the Berkeley band. Mm-hmm. But the Ridge Runners played a lot of gigs.
So how often did you play with Doc Watson?
Well, cut to coming to Los Angeles sometime 1963, 64, mm-hmm. and seeing him play, maybe 1965, at the Ash Grove. Then came, I'm trying to date this accurately, it was 63. Then came a summer when David Cohen came up to Berkeley, mm-hmm. and we lived together for that summer, and we started doing some duets.
Mm-hmm.
And through that, David recruited me to teach flat pick at the Ash Grove School of Traditional Folk Music.
Uh-huh.
And I came down and I did that, and the next time Doc Watson came in and played, I was, as ever, blown away, but that was when I was asked to pick him up at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And the gig was, you pick him up at the airport, you play with him on stage.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Well,
and
yes.
And then you had the whole ride back to the airport to get into
I'm
each other's
souls. I'm part of a tradition called Lead Boy. I was lead boy for Doc Watson.
Mm-hmm.
All of the great guitarists, country guitarists, had lead boys. And the lead, Robert Johnson, Brian Lemon Jefferson, they all had guys who took them around, you know, that were their eyes.
Uh-huh.
I was Doc's eyes. But they were also their disciples. They got to sit at the master's feet. It was a classic guru-disciple mm-hmm. relationship.
Now, how long did it stay guru-disciple? At some point, you equaled out.
Oh, never.
I don't mean like that.
Thank you.
But at some point, I mean, you're not in that position forever. At some point.
Let me tell you.
Okay, go ahead.
It's a good question.
although you could always be learning, of course, from the masters.
I didn't realize it at the time, and only later when we would talk did he let me know that I really filled a real
That was my
him.
Next question. Thank
yeah.
you. Okay, because obviously you meant something to him.
I did.
And he saw something in you that he needed. What was it? If that's not going to make you feel immodest or something.
No, because I've done a lot of things.
Because nobody can see you blush here, so it's yes.
I could play a really, really solid, unobtrusive rhythm guitar that wasn't really like bluegrass.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I don't know how technical you want me to get, but they're called clutch chords where you play mm-hmm. play that really solid, get the chords right, and I could. And I didn't realize it at the time, even though I was working really hard to do it, I could really meld with him.
Mm-hmm.
I could really sense, you know, when I should pull back a little bit on the speed and not make it sound like suddenly we're slowing down or get a little bit more aggressive. And I know now, because of what I know, because I, you know, 40 years later, but because of what he told me also, that he rode on that was a real
yes.
good platform, real good support.
I think
what
I mean, I'm smiling at you while you're talking, because what I'm hearing is, because what I know is that music is its own language and way of speaking.
Right.
That it was you could hear what he needed.
Yes.
And talk back to him. It was a conversation.
We had a dialogue on stage,
yes.
and it was thrilling. And fortunately, I was enamored and enthralled enough to never think of myself even remotely
mm-hmm.
as being even in his cosmos, let alone his league or anything. So it kept me humble.
Uh-huh.
And I just worked my little buns off to yeah. try to be as good as I could be. But I listen. I'm a hard listener.
Yes, that's
I'm
clear.
A good
if
listener.
You knew what he wanted.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's something as an audience person, which I frequently am, and there's something about seeing musicians on stage who really love each other
mm-hmm.
and who really are talking together, and they are one creature that is gorgeous.
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of what you get.
Yeah. I have these tapes because one of the benefits of being lead boy and putting somebody up at your house. That's the way it worked. He mm-hmm. stayed at my house, mm-hmm. and I took him around the city. And by the way, he had an amazing curiosity, far, far beyond what you'd think a blind guy would have. He knew science and mechanics and explained stuff to me that blew me away. If you want any examples, I'll be able
to. I like that. Because when you talk about, I think about Helen Keller, who did whatever sure. she did in four languages and was expert at geometry, which is totally visual.
Doc would be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Doc, I mean, my expectations of somebody who can't see are.
We went to Traveltown. Did we talk about Traveltown,
no.
you and I? You
no.
know what Traveltown is? Traveltown is the part of Griffith Park where they have a bunch of old locomotives.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So he would walk up. I took him to locomotives because you could touch them
uh-huh.
and climb on them and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. He was like a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But he would go up to these locomotives and he would put his hands, his arms
oh.
on the wheels. He would stretch his arms out to see how big the wheels were. And based on how big the wheels were, he would tell me where those locomotives made their hauls. Whether they were making a flat haul, those would be very, very, all the wheels would be close to the same size, as opposed to a sharp haul. I think I've got this right, or I've got it backwards.
Okay.
Either way. But when the rear driving wheels were really, really big, that was to get up a sharp hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I think. Or, again, vice versa.
Well, whichever way it was, that he knew that.
He knew that. Yeah. And he knew it to a fairly well. I mean, he could say, okay, this one here would go up a 1% grade. This one here could go up a 2%. This is the one that they use for Pikes Peak. You
mm-hmm.
know, that kind of a thing.
What did you like best about him personally? Because I know through the times that we've spoken over the years, you refer to him a lot.
Yeah.
Well, a lot. I mean, now and again, but so familiarly.
Yeah.
And maybe there isn't a what you like best.
I liked a lot. And nobody's ever asked me that question about him. I liked that he took me very seriously. From the word go, our dialogue was
mm-hmm.
two people
mm-hmm.
pretty even. Because he respected that I was intelligent. And, of course, he cared a lot that I really cared about his music.
Okay, so that's what I was...
But he took me seriously,
the change
and
from
we
the
had
Garuda,
deep
yeah.
philosophical conversations.
Yeah.
He, you know, religious, spiritual, because mm-hmm. he had, and a lot of people don't realize this about him, he had a spiritual component, spiritual side
mm-hmm.
that was every bit as big musically and spiritually as was his secular music,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't do it very much. But if you spent time with him,
oh.
you would realize just in pure terms of pure quantity,
uh-huh.
he did as much church music as he did secular music.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And it was gigantic.
To a church he belonged to, or just in
oh, yeah.
general? He
well,
liked.
To a church he belonged to, but more to, he was a Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, the canon,
yes,
whatever the
yeah.
canon
yeah.
is for Baptists, that's what he knew.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it. You know, a cappella
mm-hmm.
and accompanying it with guitar.
Mm-hmm.
He did some stuff with his wife, singing in the chorus.
Does he? So he was married all through his life to the...
Yes, he was
uh-huh.
married to Rosalie.
Does he have children?
Yes. Well, this is a sad thing.
Oh.
He had two children. One of them, Nancy, is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, Merle.
Mm-hmm.
Most people know as much about Merle as they know about Doc.
Mm-hmm.
But Merle was a son who's a little bit younger, was a little bit younger than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that because at a certain point I thought that I was going to be kind of a permanent accompanist to Doc.
Mm-hmm.
But he wanted to work his son into the
mm-hmm.
act, and you're not going to argue with that.
Right. And
Merle,
that's what he did?
Yeah, he did.
Mm-hmm.
Merle died in a tractor accident.
Oh, my.
And it's been a long, long time now.
Mm-hmm.
It's been at least 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, really crushed Doc.
Oh.
And when he came back from it, and there was a question whether he was going to get back into it
mm-hmm.
after that, he dedicated a festival called Merle Fest.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say it to anybody mm-hmm. in the folk music world, you'll say, oh, God, Merle Fest. Yeah, sure, Merle Watson, blah, blah, blah.
So this, I'm curious about something. You're referring to it as folk music in the folk music world. Do you put bluegrass under that umbrella?
You have to.
I didn't know because I never saw. I never knew. I only know the differences,
yeah.
so I didn't know.
You have to,
uh-huh.
I mean, but you have to very broadly define folk music as an indigenous,
oh, yes,
non-formal, non-classical music
yes.
reflecting the
yes. I forgot
the
about the bigger definition of folk,
but
of course.
The term that they've been using for a while now, and I like it personally, is roots music, but it's a little bit self-conscious. If you say folk music, you're kind of putting it all out there and daring people to say, oh yeah, Michael, row your boat ashore.
I was going to say, because I think for a lot of people, myself included, and as much as I know about this music, I see folk music as Michael rode the bull and if
right.
I had a hammer.
Yeah.
And the, yes. And
well,
that short span in the 60s, which somebody called what the, oh, I'm going to get blasted for this.
I but think
the folk music epidemic.
Let's call that with a capital F.
No, that's fine. Yes.
And let's call what I'm saying. And by the way, a lot of people wouldn't say what I'm saying. They would say, no, I played bluegrass or blues or roots. Or, you know, I never was with those, you know.
Right. Well, folk costumes,
Boys,
folk dancing, folk anything is
right.
What reflects the, yes, of course.
Right.
Thank you for that.
But I
yeah.
think that, you know, folk music as, a catch-all for generic American vernacular
mm-hmm.
music
mm-hmm.
Is about right. You know, there's a very, very famous anthology. It's the anthology called the Harry Smith. I think it's called the Folk Music Anthology.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 6, now it's an 8, but the real deal is a 3-volume, 6-record compendium anthology of this guy named Harry Smith put together for Folkways Records.
Mm-hmm.
And almost anybody like me mm-hmm. playing music from that, who learned music in that era goes
mm-hmm.
to the Harry Smith anthology. If you say it and somebody says, I know what that is, they're serious.
Mm-hmm.
So folk music, yeah, it's American indigenous popular music.
Thank you. So I have another question. Last night we were talking and you started to say something about Frank Sinatra and
right.
recording before,
yes.
and then you stopped.
Yes.
Will you say what that was?
Sure.
I'm so curious.
Yeah. Well, you're sort of, at this point in time, the logical or the chronological or the technological, you're at this
We've
end of
past.
It.
We've skipped past. I know. I want to
right.
back up. Yes.
If you, and the question, the point that I was making is with all the technological stuff that we've got on our command, there's GarageBand and being
mm-hmm.
able to go
mm-hmm.
into a studio and have as many tracks as you want to redo music tracks over and over and over again until you get it right. Frank Sinatra and those bands
mm-hmm.
got it in one take.
Yes.
They only had one take.
Yes.
I mean, it's not like they had one single, that's all the takes you get,
mm-hmm.
but they couldn't fool around with that take. If there was something wrong, they had to take it again. So now you're talking about Frank Sinatra, 4 backup singers, and a band of maybe 30 pieces
yes.
getting it right the first time,
mm-hmm.
and you think about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really something. You hear real professional musicians do that all the time, you know, including quote-unquote folk musicians.
Mm-hmm.
But it's real different from the mentality even of knowing that you can always make that good. You can always do that again.
Mm-hmm.
No, you can't. You got to get it right. And there's something about having
that's
to
a good
get
push.
It right.
Uh-huh.
Having to get it right, you get your act together.
Yes. Yes.
Or you're a laughing stock.
You don't end up on the auto-tune roster.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And I think
yes.
as people are learning about that, we're taking some
roster,
of these,
yes.
whatever you call this group of people who are singing and they got auto-tune behind them. And I realized, well, with enough auto-tune, I could be up there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it does take something away.
It takes a lot away. And I don't know what the outcome of all this is going to be. I don't know whether it's going to be a good thing that everybody can make quote-unquote professional sounding music, or it's not a good thing. And I mean it. I mean it. I would like to think it isn't a good thing.
I think it isn't a good thing.
But at the same time,
I think too much equality.
That's my feeling, but that's not a politically correct thing to say. I don't know if you can say that.
There's such a thing as the best. I mean,
well, yeah.
And by the way, I think it's less confusing if what you're presented with is the best.
Yeah.
Instead of too much average.
Amen.
Which I think the world's too full of.
That's
all right. So
really well
this
said.
Isn't about me. Let me ask you something. So who would get your love letter right now?
Oh gosh. I decided not to think about this.
That's that's fine.
You told me not to.
The fun of it is kind of thinking about it, because that's part of the joy. You know, sometimes you just pull a name up, somebody who's meant something to you. I mean, I don't think a love letter is a one-shot deal. I think sometimes it's a nice way of life. The obvious thing would be, of course, one to Doc Watson.
And I thought about this.
Wouldn't hurt.
I thought a lot about it. I don't know if I'm intimidated by coming to Doc and saying, here's what you did for me, to me, because there is a slightly darker side of this, too. So I'm not sure that...
Which would preclude you talking about the other side?
No, it wouldn't preclude it, but...
Make it hard?
I've lived in his shadow also.
Oh, I see.
He was this giant figure in my life.
Yes.
Probably I was having this conversation with somebody the other day. With the possible exception of my father, the central male figure in my life. Because I met him when I was 23. And he has been at the core of my music, the playing of it, but the conception of myself as a musician, I've always measured myself as, you know, how good compared to Doc Watson am I?
Isn't that a beautiful love letter right there? Let me just ask you.
I wish, and I'm wondering if Doc Watson would have said, son, son, I'm pleased to hear you say that to me. And it makes me feel really good to know that you care that much about what I brought into your life. But, son, you got to go on and be your own player. You got to be your own man.
Oh, gee, I think you should. I wish you had a typewriter here. I wish you were just writing all this down.
Well, you caught it on tape.
I know. I think that's great.
That's what he possibly probably would have said. I wouldn't want, son, I wouldn't want you to be sitting in there trying to recreate what I did. I already did that. Now you go and do it. You got some talent. You go and do that yourself, son.
See, I think anything you want to say to a person who's been that huge in your life is a gift to that person and to you, because you're just bathing in mostly the positive, depending on how you look at it. You know?
Yeah.
That you were chosen by this man somehow.
Oh, that's the way I feel about it.
Uh-huh.
Chosen.
Come sit in my shadow and my shade, and let's just tromp the world together however we do it.
With pleasure.
Is such a compliment to you. And also, can I say something else?
Yeah, certainly.
This is,
help.
I really do. I think this is historically, music history, I think this would be a historically important letter for somebody to find in a generation sitting in some box. I do.
I love that you said that because he was a musical fact.
And so were you, and you still are. This being found by his grandchildren or great-grandchildren and how much more they would know about him? But go ahead.
I'm trying to think about that.
Found letters are a wonder.
You know, the sheer amount of information that we're engulfed in with, whatever, you know, makes me wonder what's important and what's not. You know, what would be important to somebody?
Oh, well, you're shrugging your shoulders, but you're not somebody. I think, you know, whenever you see, so often you see headlines, letters found by that little boy to Jackie Robinson.
Right.
And it made headlines because it was in his own handwriting, these letters back and forth.
Right.
And there is something magical about that.
Well, I think maybe somebody who was in on the ground floor with Doc in on the early, early days before while he was still schlepping around in, copier repairman pants and, you know, a plain white shirt, because that's what he traveled with. You didn't want to have a different colored shirt if you're blind. You know, the early days when he had no retinue and nobody meeting him at the airport and, you know, people were seeing him for the first time. Yeah, to be recording what your impressions were of seeing him.
I think that would be great. And that's one of those things where you have to really, you know, they talk about real faith being planting a tree under whose branches you will never sit.
Okay.
You know, it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, I like that.
That just, you have to just, it's a gift to the future from you in your handwriting.
Oh.
And somebody will find it. And by the way, just quickly, who do you mail this to? Because a love letter's got to be mailed and, you know, stamped and mailed and received to be, I think, really valuable.
Yeah.
His daughter or to yourself?
I think to his wife.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Who I had a relationship with.
Oh, then perfect. I hope you'll do that. It's something to think about.
Sure.
Okay.
I could send this to Rosalie.
Oh, I think that she would be probably so touched.
Yeah, she's quite aged now, and she's going to be bereft.
Well, she's bereft, and your letter will help.
You think so?
I know it. I know it just from so much experience. Thank you for doing this with me.
It's been my pleasure.
Mine too. I wish we could do more. If you have more to say at some other time and you want to do another one,
sure.
I hope you will. Okay.
I would love to.
Thank you, my dear.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
That. This is Janet Gallen saying goodbye. And please remember, if you think you have to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, that writing a love letter is a special occasion. Goodbye for now.